Teamwork is wonderful because it addresses questions that the bleeding disorder community has had for a long time.
That voice belongs to Oklahoma resident John Faria, a National Hemophilia Foundation board member, blood brother, and one of the community participants in HemeWork, a new professional advancement and career-building resource platform for the bleeding disorders community made possible by Genentech. John joins Amy and I a bit later in the pod to share his professional journey and perspective as a man, husband, and father living with hemophilia. We have a lot to get to today, and get to it we will, but first, hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast. I'm your host, Patrick James Lynch, alongside my co-hosts, Amy Board. Hello, Amy.
Hello, everybody.
And co-host and pregnant wife, Natalie Lynch. How are you doing, Natalie?
I'm doing well. Thanks.
Yeah. There really is a lot going on. As you know, NHF's BDC came to a close only a little over a week ago. And as we record this, HFA's 2020 symposium is currently underway. So to hear a little bit more about the goings-on at HFA 2020, here is Creative Director Michael DeGrandpre and Program Director Carrie Koenig with more.
Hey everyone, this is Michael with the Hemophilia Federation of America, and we would love to have you join us for our annual symposium, which is going on right now. Our theme for 2020 is Charting Our Future, which is an opportunity for us to look at all the great things that are happening in our community and figure out exactly how we can use those to chart the best future for each and every one of us. It's very easy to log on. All you have to do is visit our website, hemophiliafed.org/symposium, and register or log on. Carrie, do you want to tell us a little bit more about what's going on, what people can expect?
Sure, I'd love to. We have so much great content coming this year. We have education for everyone, Sangre Latina, fitness sessions, children's art, mental health and well-being. We have policy and advocacy on the horizon where we will learn how we're going to chart our future and what's coming in the bleeding disorders community, and much, much more.
Fantastic. We look forward very much to having everyone join us for the remainder of the symposium. And of course, after the end of this week, all of this great content will be available through the end of December. So if you aren't able to make it with us, we would love to have you join us and engage with some of the great content that we've got available online. And again, just visit hemophiliafed.org/symposium and unlock your key to charting your future.
Thank you, Michael. And Carrie, hemophiliafed.org for more on Symposium, which, by the way, is made possible in part by what we call diamond sponsors, such as Takeda, who, wouldn't you know, are also the presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream Podcast and have a little website called bleedingdisorders.com, where you can learn more about their work in and commitment to the bleeding disorders community. And you can download for free the latest copy of their magazine, Hello Factor. So download the mag and check out the resources at bleedingdisorders.com. We do have a beast of an article to break down and react to here in just a moment. But before we do, Amy, I would love if you could give us the latest on the It's in the Genes podcast. I know we're rapidly approaching the end of season one, and shout out to our sponsor BioMarin on that. So tell us, where are we with It's in the Genes?
Well, after three episodes of profound science, researchers, a clinical trial nurse, we finally get to hear from a patient who has spent months and months and months in the decision-making process whether or not to participate in a gene therapy trial. He is wonderful. He's articulate. He's authentic. Jimmy has sickle cell disease, and he has decided to go through with a gene therapy trial. And the process has so many highs, so many lows, physical highs, physical lows, as well as emotional. And he has a wonderful story to share. And so if there's one episode that you listen to, I personally would recommend this episode. It's wonderful.
I actually just listened to it in its finished form yesterday. And to that point, Amy, you don't need to have listened to the prior ones. You can just kind of jump in on this one, episode four, right, Amy?
Exactly. Episode four.
Jump in on episode four with Jimmy Olga here. You will hear someone who has been very thoughtful and deliberate in this decision-making process and really get a great sense of some of the psychological and emotional considerations that go into considering a gene therapy treatment. So shout out to Jimmy for coming on again. Thanks to BioMarin for supporting that project. And thank you, Amy, for being a killer host, writer, producer of it. We also have Stop the Bleeding, may have heard of it, season 10.
10.
Season 10.
10.
It debuts on Monday, August 31st. Our summer at a virtual camp, I Don't Wanna Bleed, 2 episodes a day, 10 episodes in total, Monday through Friday next week. And what a pivot and what a season we have pulled off. I could not be prouder of the entire team. It has come together so incredibly well.
100% of the cast filmed in their homes over Zoom. And so, like, props had to be shipped. Like, I think Seth Kirshner received like 8 pounds of tater tots from our video producer, Drama, in order to film his
important
scenes.
Work that we do over here, everybody.
Incredible. And I have to, and I know Patrick and Natalie agree, we have to shout out our editors that have taken this thing. Joshua Sterling Bragg and Allison Stoney. Hats off to the two of them for crushing this very tricky deadline. I mean, it was a lot, way more than previous seasons that we were able to, you know, film on location. And I can't wait to see the finished product. It's going to be great. And the scripts are great. Like, the fact that it was filmed over Zoom. I mean, this might be the best season ever. I don't want to, like, hype it too much, but holy cannoli.
It's pretty special. We also have some great cameos from clinical professionals in the community, names you might recognize. Clinical counselor Debbie De La Riva. She does some guided meditation as part of one of the episodes. Physical therapist Grace Hernandez presents some innovative ways you can bring camp exercising, strengthening, and stretching activities into your own home. And nurse Hope Woodcock-Ross works with Camper Zach on how to self-infuse anywhere in a demonstration that, I gotta say, went way better than I thought it was gonna go over Zoom. I did not know if that was gonna be interesting at all. Turned out it was so interesting, we made it much longer than I thought we were gonna make it. So shout out to Hope and Zach for making the most out of that segment. So again, Stop the Bleeding, Monday, stbhemo.com. Episodes will be uploaded to the Stop the Bleeding Facebook, Instagram, and Bloodstream Media YouTube channels, or you can go to stbhemo.com for a one-stop shop with all episodes from all seasons of Stop the Bleeding. And one last thing before we get into the article, we want to thank this month's segment sponsor, Genentech, who is continuing to support the hemophilia community. Last month, we talked about the launch of GenentechHemophilia.com, a website showcasing Genentech's efforts to advance all aspects of life with hemophilia. Today, we're talking about a video on the site focused on how Genentech monitors the safety of their medicines during and after clinical trials, a process called pharmacovigilance. Visit GenentechHemophilia.com or click the link in the program notes to watch that video on pharmacovigilance. But it is now time for us to get into the article that we've been spending quite a bit of time here off mic discussing and breaking down amongst ourselves. It's a big article. Amy actually introduced Natalie and I to it just a few days ago, said we absolutely have to talk about this on Bloodstream. It was very clear why almost immediately. So, Amy, if you would just kind of set it up for us, some background on this article in The Atlantic called When the Misdiagnosis is Child Abuse.
You bet. Yeah, as you mentioned, I happened upon this article from The Atlantic over the weekend. The article was written by Stephanie Clifford in collaboration with the Marshall Project. For those that don't know, I had to do some research on this. The Marshall Project is a nonprofit organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. And it kind of blew my mind. This is a collaboration of journalists that actually are funded by a grant to dive into some of these issues. So the article was well investigated, well written, and we will provide the link in the program notes, actually, so you can read read the thing in its entirety. But what caught my eye was the title, obviously, When Misdiagnosis is Child Abuse. And according to this article, there's a relatively new subspecialty in pediatrics, which I was unaware of. This specific pediatrician is trained to determine whether kids' injuries are accidental. Such assessments can be subjective, but they're often accepted as fact. And when they are wrong, parents can needlessly end up in jail. And I don't need to explain for our bleeding disorder community listeners why this title popped, but for those who are curious, many bleeding disorder families have been questioned or investigated for child abuse due to excessive bleeding, bruising, etc., due to their bleeding disorder. And as a chapter executive director, I have to mention it's unfortunate how common this is for bleeding disorder families.
So, Amy, was there anything in the article that you found particularly striking?
This article profiled two families who went to the ER with their infants that were experiencing intense symptoms. And one family, the infant couldn't breathe. The child was wheezing. It looked like the child was swallowing milk in like a different or wrong, quote unquote, way. And the other, the father found the child with purple lips and completely shaking. So both families called 911 and they immediately went to the ER. And during the course of the exam, the medical staff at the ER started to become suspicious of the particular symptoms and called in a caseworker and a pediatrician who specializes in identifying child abuse injuries. And this is standard procedure. And I just want to personally mention that we applaud medical staff for erring on the side of caution, but that's where all of this begins.
Right. Yes. And of course, like, child abuse is something we all would like to see eradicated. But how big a problem is it? Like, what is it that we're trying to tackle? Or what? Give us some perspective on that, if you can.
Sure. To quote directly from the article, which was so well written by Stephanie Clifford, child abuse is pervasive and it's a very complex problem. Few children or abusers report harm themselves, so it's up to other authorities, such as medical personnel or teachers or bystanders, such as neighbors, to report suspected abuse. Some 3.5 million children in America were reported as being suspected victims of child abuse in 2018. And the most recent year for data, which was available, is about 680,000 were ultimately determined by authorities to have been abused or neglected. It's a huge number.
It is, and yet it's much smaller than 3.5 million, which is the number reported. So, you know, kind of immediately puts a question in the head. What exactly, how big is the problem, and maybe who are we adding into the decision-making process to help shine more light on that problem?
Absolutely. So when suspected abuse has a medical component, like an injury or a bruise, child abuse pediatricians step in to examine those injuries and to rule out causes other than abuse, such as disease, or to consider the family's explanations. And these pediatricians are trained in what types of fractures generally stem from abuse and what bleeding patterns in the brain can be caused by shaking. With an abuse expert on staff, the thinking goes, regular pediatricians don't need to worry about overreacting to an innocent bruise or missing warning signs because parents are convincing liars. Child welfare workers also rely on this expertise as they consider removing children from their homes. The American Board of Pediatrics certifies the first group of child abuse pediatricians in 2009, and there are now 344 such specialists nationally stationed in all but three states.
There's only about 11 years old, this child abuse pediatrician specialist. Is that about 11 years and there's 344 of them, you just said?
Yes, 344. And I had no idea the subspecialty existed.
Same.
And I will mention that they are not required to disclose that they are the subspecialty in the room.
So when they're interviewing these parents, it's they have no idea that they're looking at a lens through a lens. So a scared parent might just who doesn't know why this is happening just start rattling off stuff that could then be potentially misconstrued and used as incriminating. Testimony.
Yeah.
Anything said may be held against you in a family court, but you don't get that warning.
Yep. And this article mentions that a review of dozens of cases, including thousands of pages of medical records, child welfare agency records, and testimony, along with court decisions, contracts, and emails from child abuse pediatricians, it shows that these doctors in particular can have a near unilateral power in labeling abuse. Even though their conclusions are sometimes at odds with the opinions of specialists like orthopedists and hematologists, their judgments are echoed, amplified, and often unblinkingly accepted by investigators. Maxine Eichner, who is a family law professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law, was quoted in the article by saying, "The first time I started to hear what parents are going through, I was shocked." She continues to say, "There should be a role for child abuse pediatricians, but many are going well beyond their medical expertise and wielding the power of diagnosis in ways that are really harmful for children and families." And it wasn't surprising in this article. It came up at the end, but I knew where this was leading. I think Patrick and Natalie agreed with me. It was not surprising that one of the families profiled in this article ended up being diagnosed with a Factor VII deficiency. and the case was truly a worse scenario for the parents who have a bleeding disorder history in their family and were not aware of the diagnosis. The child in the story had a brain bleed and tragically passed away while the parents were being detained before the diagnosis came through. The genetic testing of the parents took months and months and months. And sure enough, both parents lacked the factor 7 gene. And I think what was most troubling about this particular situation was the initial report written by the child abuse pediatrician was just what the standard language of that case was going forward, that this was a brain bleed due to excessive shaking. And the diagnosis of factor 7 was not examined, I think to the extent of what it should be, while the father was incarcerated for a time. It's tragic. And so I just, you know, obviously the story touched us very personally and would love to hear, Patrick, your thoughts as you read and kind of meditated on the story.
Yeah, this was a hard read. I had to stop every couple paragraphs the first time through because I was getting pretty emotional for a number of reasons. And kudos to you, Amy. You've just presented something that is dense and an emotional read. I recommend you read it, listeners. But you've presented it in a way that really helped kind of just spell out the facts, and the article itself will really bring out the emotion in the stories for those who are interested. I'd say the thing, there's two things that I guess for me feel most pressing, one of which you've spoken to, but I feel it important to underscore, and that is this near unilateral decision that these child abuse pediatricians, a position created 11 years ago that does not necessitate education on things like rare bleeding disorders that could result in difficult to explain bleeding. It does not require, and in fact overrides, expertise of people such as hematologists and other experts like orthopedists, as mentioned here in the article. The fact that one individual can make a determination, an individual who's, and the article gets into the money tree and where these physicians are making their money from, and I think that's always a bit of a complicated argument. It becomes too easy to just kind of point to follow the money as like the be-all end-all, so I don't necessarily take that stance. However, I think it is an important factor in this equation, and that people like Mr. Santiago can spend a year and a half in jail, his children go without a father, his partner contemplating suicide, his family dead broke, all because one person determined that the child must have been abused by these parents, in spite of the fact that Mr. Santiago even mentioned that his family had a history of bad blood, which we know this happens all the time in the community, especially for people in the U.S. for whom English is not their first language. They may not have a great grasp on the family history. Even if it is hemophilia A or B, something a little bit more common than, say, factor 7 deficiency, they still may not have a great grasp on the family history or what exactly the problem is for a whole host of reasons. But the important point is that Mr. Santiago gave them an extraordinary clue. And then to the point Amy made, it does not sound as though appropriate steps were taken to explore what that clue might reveal. Instead, we moved forward with one child abuse pediatrician's opinion of the matter, and it ruined this family's life. And that, I guess it gets to the other thing I wanted to point out. This bothers me. A 2017 study, researchers gave child abuse pediatricians cases of potential abuse with certain socioeconomic cues about the victim's family, such as unemployed caregivers. They were establishing class. When researchers reversed those cues, for example, by telling the doctors the caregivers were professionals, they found that the diagnostic decisions changed in 40% of cases. 40% of cases. That's not a rounding error.
Well, I think what's interesting is if you're going to put so much weight on one person, a child abuse pediatrician's assessment, but that in 40% of cases where the factor of class has changed, their professional opinion changes, it can't be held, like, that's too big of a swing with a piece of information that has nothing to do with the actual x-rays, with the brain scans, with the bruising pattern.
Physical presentation.
The physical presentation. And granted, it's important to get a whole picture of the family and all the factors, but if class factors or race factors change the outcomes of the medical decision in 40% of the cases, this can't be ruled by one person. That alone, that fact alone, shows that it needs to be a committee. Or three child abuse pediatricians who all three of them give their separate opinions. But also just the sheer numbers of 344 divided by 47, because they said three states don't have any of these pediatricians in them, is just slightly over 7 per state. To deal with 3.5 million cases divided by 47, which I didn't do that math, but that's a lot. That's a lot of cases to look at.
It's more than 40 hours of work a week
for one person who's changing decisions based on seeing like whether someone's employed or unemployed, whether someone's black or white. So there's clearly systemic issues. And again, I don't think any of the three of us think that child abuse is not a problem or shouldn't be investigated. And mandatory reporters, like I think there are many stories of children whose lives have been saved because there have been these systems put into place. But now that we're seeing that these are that there's a lot of gaps and that it's actually ruining a great percentage of families who are innocent, the system needs to be reevaluated. This article really, really, really touches home for me and really, really, really impacted me emotionally because I have a really good friend, that's a lot of reallys, who is currently in a court case right now and potentially could be taken away from her family. I reached out to her and she had read this article and actually knows kind of the grandfather of child abuse pediatricians, or, you know, his work got state mandates in mandatory reporters in place, Dr. Eli Neuberger. But yeah, my friend knows and has worked with a few people mentioned in this article. And I hope that in the next couple weeks, I can have an interview with her and maybe some of the experts from this article to just kind of get some other opinions and an opinion of someone whose family's currently facing this right now.
And I will mention that Dr. Neuberger, was the grandfather of kind of mapping and organizing the system in order to not see the child a second time or have the child die after they've already been seen by an ER or some type of clinical establishment. But he has not endorsed this subspecialty of child abuse pediatricians. He sees it as troubling, where the system is really narrowed in on that one person, like you were saying.
Yeah, he mentioned becoming uncomfortable with it as a quote, transformed into a very much criminalized approach, less primarily on understanding and help than on developing an evidentiary base for prosecution and pursuing perpetrators. I love the way he articulates that because I think it speaks to problems that go beyond child abuse investigations going awry, but how the criminal justice system can put a lens on a situation that it becomes inescapable.
And I think his system that he designed was truly empowering every member of the team to identify and work together and build the story together. And so there was no expert per se. And I realize, I get it in a human mind, like, wouldn't it be great to have an expert that could look at an x-ray and determine if this child, you know, has a rare disease or if he was being shook. I understand that, but I think there is beauty in trying to determine and do your due diligence to really get into the story. And I think there, in my humble opinion, reading other articles, seeing several documentaries, there's a recent documentary on Netflix called The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez, which is the other lens where the system missed child abuse. And it was very clear. And there were four social workers that just missed and did not take action to get that child out of the home. And that child ended up dead. And I do think that Our system is incredibly burdened. 3.5 million children are suspected of child abuse every year, and that is a huge number. And so how can the system empower healthcare professionals, social workers, caseworkers to work together so no child, no family is missed? And I don't believe that everyone should have expertise on rare and ultra rare diseases such as a factor 7 deficiency. However, to have it in your arsenal, in your Rolodex, to understand that there are people that are specializing in this, it just blew my mind that nowhere in this article was it mentioned that a hematologist was able to override any of this in the case of Mr. Santiago, about what factor deficiency actually is, and perhaps that could have been the cause of this brain bleed. It blew my mind.
So what can we do with this? Again, I encourage everyone to read this article, to absorb what it's saying, especially if you're a member of this bleeding disorders community. To Amy's point, these are not other people's problems. This happens to us all the time. I would say one thing that I would recommend parents do, write as many notes about your child as possible. Speak to doctors, get different opinions, document those. Amy, what can people do on a bigger level to try to affect change that improves the way that we look at child abuse in the U.S.?
My fear, in particular with the bleeding disorder community and families that experience factor 8, factor 9, and other rare clotting deficiencies, is my fear is that the families that don't know there is a spontaneous mutation, they don't speak of their blood disorder, bad blood in the family. These are the families that are going to be, they're going to experience this the most. And so there's a piece of me that here we are with new leadership at the National Hemophilia Foundation that is imploring patients to reach out of what is most important to you. And I really think that NHF is in a really great position to infiltrate and kind of educate the system a little bit about, in particular, who can you go to in your state to have a well-designed diagnosis? Is there a hematologist that can be connected to some of these child abuse pediatricians? There's 344 across the state. Do they have a national conference? Can we show up and, you know, educate a little bit about what bleeding disorders are? And they're not required to know everything, but there are people out there in every state that do. They just do. Can we get them connected to Dr. Pipe? Dr. Guy Young, you know, someone that can educate and inform the case going forward to make the best possible decision for the child, the state, and the family.
I believe the answer is yes. It's a matter of time, effort, and money. But mm-hmm. Yes, we can connect human beings to one another. Natalie, do you have any kind of closing thoughts as we start to wrap up this topic?
I mean, I can't imagine that someone who goes into the field of child abuse pediatrician is not coming from a good place. So I think being able to educate them about our community, and like Amy said, like, is there a once a year national conference for these 344 people where a representative can go and say, hey, this is a little bit extra information about bleeding disorders. And also, if you're ever working on a case where like bleeding seems interesting or different to you or excessive and all the other pieces don't line up, this is a person you can reach out to just be like, hey, before I make this really life-changing opinion that might put someone else in jail, can you take a look at this? That feels important. And just what you were saying before, Patrick, informing regular doctors and pediatricians to when they see, I mean, we had an experience this week with our midwife who noticed a salmon patch on my leg that I've had since birth, that looks like a pattern of bruising down my leg that has in the past in my life. I've been asked about domestic abuse. I've been asked in elementary school about, you know, what are those bruises on your legs? But our midwife warned us about our unborn child, that if this child also has this patch of discoloration, we might get questioned about child abuse, about a baby that's not even here yet, who may or may not have this thing, and put that in our heads. And I mean, I think that's very, very rare. So, you know, even just doctors yes. who are talking to patients at any point, just being like, if there's something that's different or strange that you're like, this is to protect yourself, ultimately, to photograph it, to document it, to write it down, to bring it up to a pediatrician, to be like, can you look at this? Can you document it in my child's records? I think, you know, a little bit of advocacy on the parent's side, a little bit of advocacy on the health professional side, and then systemic change, I think, could all help make this system that's in place for a good reason better.
All right, Amy, thank you for this necessary, difficult discussion. This is why we have a podcast. And thank you to Genentech for sponsoring this segment. Once again, remember to check out GenentechHemophilia.com to watch their video about Genentech's commitment to safety. We're going to take a quick break and we will be right back. The Bloodstream podcast is made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. To learn more about all that Takeda does for people affected by hemophilia, von Willebrand disease, and other rare inherited bleeding disorders, visit bleedingdisorders.com. Easy website, my favorite kind, bleedingdisorders.com. And for the support of the Bloodstream podcast, we like to say, thanks, Takeda. And now you're going to jump into a conversation that Amy and I had with John Faria, NHF board member, blood brother, and a member of the HemeWork project that Believe Limited has also had a role in creating the video series for. That's all about professional advancement and the career journeys of various people in our community.
As a chapter executive director, I begged community members to let me know what they were interested in terms of programming. And I would say overwhelmingly the response, you know, you'd always get like one or two responses because that's how it works. But overwhelmingly the response was career counseling. You know, help me to figure out what I want to do. How do I get a job? So important. And Genentech did, you know, classic focus groups. They did advocacy panels. They had advocacy summits where they invited community leaders, patients, you know, to really discuss about what were the gaps in the community. And I wasn't surprised at all. The overwhelming response was, we want to be we want to have an avenue and a resource to build career with all stages of career. So HemeWork was really developed as not only as a resource for people in the community to find jobs, to figure out what they want to do, but also to inspire. We have five folks, community members, that shared their stories. And the thing that was really beautiful is everybody, every one of them, has had a piece of success. They've had a piece of hardship. They've had a piece of, I don't know what I want to do with my life. And so there was just this beautiful arc of, I've given myself to my passion and now I've made a decision where I can't do my passion anymore. And how do I do that? Because of my joints, because of my bleeding disorder, because of financial issues, how do I pivot? And it's really lovely. And Genentech has created HemeWork, wonderful website, in partnership with HFA. HFA has marvelous resources for career counseling on their website. So it's lovely. And John was one of our participants. And the thing that I loved most about John is that John loves this in his own local community in Oklahoma. John prides himself on mentoring young men and women that are coming up in the world that are trying to figure out, what do I want to do with my life? And how do I weigh my passions versus, you know, what will be, you know, stable? And how could I do both together? And how can I adapt to make that possible? And he was an integral part of our video series, an integral part of this project for Genentech and HemeWork. So I'm really excited to have him on the podcast today to share more about his story.
Likewise. Yeah. So let's do it. Let's jump right into the conversation with John Faria.
So I figured out, so there's three areas of talking about career stuff. There's three, you can't see this, and it's backwards.
Three.
So there's three areas of expertise that you need to develop in a white, in a business white collar executive capacity. And it took me until today to really realize it, which is good job, John.
Well, great timing. I'm glad you're here with us.
It is technical, your ability to technically consult, technical consulting, your ability to managerially, which I hope that's a word, managerial consulting, right? Which is the art of managing people, right? And then business consulting, which is the art of building, developing a business, right?
You only realized that today. Can you expand on that? Like, what do you mean by that?
So I've been analyzing the deficiencies in the Canadian. So I work for a multinational technology firm that does transportation, logistics, supply chain, trade, compliance, telematics, all the things in the supply chain and transportation space.
Okay.
And I realized that we have gaps in the organization, right? Just like every organization has gaps. So I finally figured out that it's because resources can't, I'm not typical in I can do all three of the, it's arguable how good I do all three of those things, but I can do all three of those functions for an organization, whether it's talking about the technical stack, talking about how we're managing people or customers, or talking about, what's the other one? Managerial, technical.
Business.
And then business. Yeah. How are we growing the business, right? What is the business strategy? How are we doing to plan? How are we creating that plan? What does that look like? And that's not a typical brains out there. They can't think of those things. It's like having a churn. It's like a blender, right? Have those three things banging around there at the same time is a lot for the average brain. So
yes, I was thinking that as you said that, like that, those are three very different verticals to consider. So yeah. How have you sort of, and I guess kind of tying this to heme work and what it means to be a person with hemophilia.
Right.
Have you consciously kind of added on skills, added value to yourself as you've gone because you've noticed something about professional advancement, or how did you get to a place where you feel confident in your abilities to add value across those three different elements of that you framed as being critical for advancement in white collar business?
Yeah, exactly. So it's definitely critical, and that's personal and professional, right? The understanding that those are the three areas you can add value in life and in just your relationships too, right? It's super important. So really, it's just been working on problems. I'm fortunate enough where I'm the problems guy.
What does that mean?
Curse, really. Yes. Yeah, like, hey, look, a big problem, and you throw me at it, which is good. And like I koala myself to whatever the problem is, right? And then it's my face on the problem now, and you know all the big problem is like, oh, these people are really difficult. Let's have John work with them. And I'm like, that's great. Can I get the nice people? Why do I have to get the? And so my career has been a series of working with all the problems. So that's where it's kind of dawned on me today. Where I'm like, gosh, why didn't this person think around the challenge? I was talking to I have an executive, right? And I was talking to him, and I'm like, he's a director, right? Why can't he just jump on the call and fix the problems? Like I can do that. Why can't everybody do that? And he shook his head. He's like, no, you have to prepare people. And I'm like, yeah, but you know, if you got a title, just go do it. And it's like, oh wait, no. And he's like, that's not how life is, John. You just throw somebody at something. And I'm like, well, you've been doing that to me. You've only known me for 6 months. So I figured out that that's not typical. You know, it's like, oh, he's more of a technical resource. I need to throw him at the technical things. Oh, he's more of a people person. I need to throw him at the people, yeah. You know, and that's the typical thing. And it's kind of setting yourself up for success in the short term, but really everybody needs to grow. And I studied expertise. My career, advisor during when I did psychological research was an expert in expertise, which is the funniest thing.
Wow. We have to stop there. What does that mean?
Like she's an expert. She's worked 25 years or more studying the phenomenon known as expertise. Yeah.
I'm so, hilarious. That's so interesting to me.
There's a little alliteration slash whatever the other thing is on that. It's an expert in expertise. It rolls. It's so good. I need to get her a t-shirt now. It's been 10 years in the coming. So I learned. So it takes you about a decade. Anyway, so through my work with this expert in expertise, it takes you about a decade to become an expert in something. And it's not just time, it's number of hits, right? So like, how do you become an expert fireman? Well, you take 10 years to do it. How do you become an expert? What the hell have I been doing? Enterprise technology. That's what my thing is, right? So I've been doing it for over 10 years. And you also need to marry that up, just like language. It takes you about 10 years to be like a, at least 10 years to be like a fluent you know, graduate student, especially in foreign language, right? It takes you that long to get there just organically.
Does that correlate with that 10,000 hours thing that
exactly you hear about sometimes? And you have to do a minimum. That's the next part. You have to do a minimum of 4,000 hours, and the 4,000 hours need to be to actively be improving in that thing. So like 10,000 hours of activity, yeah, you'll get there. But if like 2,000 hours of that is just minimal improvement, like I just kind of do it on the side. So I tried to teach myself Japanese, you know, and I took 3 years of my life to devote to learning Japanese. And about half the time, I was just having fun learning kanji and hiragana because it's a different alphabet, but they have three. The Japanese, because they're better than us, we're like, an alphabet, buddy? I'm going to make three alphabets, and you're going
to
deal with
it. You know what I love about that? I think of Japanese people as being very efficient, and we have to use inches and 12 inches to a foot and all this stupid stuff, and it's like, why can't we just use a metric system like the rest of the world? So kudos to the Japanese for being like, you know what? We got three alphabets. Sometimes complexity is preferred.
Not two. No, we're going to use three, and you enjoy that, you know?
I think that's fantastic.
And I thought that was fascinating. Anyway, so but 4,000 hours to improve on this language learning. I was just having fun because it's fun to like learn how to draw the calligraphy in the Japanese Chinese iconography is just like, it's just mind blowing. Anyway, so sometimes I just write and you'd have to write them like a million times to understand, because it's just like, literally, it's like, here's Patrick, here's a character that means pie. And like, how do you memorize that? How do you know how to draw that?
You've just got to memorize it, I guess. You repeat, right? Repeat.
You would go through my workbook, and I literally have just pages of me learning hiragana and katakana. And like, you'd be like, John really wrote this like 100, 150 times. Like, yeah, you have to. I don't know. Like, how did you learn to write the letter A, Patrick?
I can interject to ask you both a question, because John, you speak about this in the HEMWORK videos, and we spoke about it, you know, you and I at length. I think so many young people today are stuck between seeing what they are passionate about and not being able to like figure out how to do that to actually like make an income. And affiliate into that, like if your passion is rock climbing per se, and like, well, how in the world can I make a career doing that? Is it safe for me to do that, you know, with my body? Talk to me a little bit about both of you. I would love to hear like where your struggle was when you were young when it comes to passionate stuff. Anyway.
Right. I love that topic, because that's the topic that I did not get to dive deep with Patrick when we were doing the life coaching that I was doing for Patrick, because he like had an extra hour to just listen to me ramble. I am, kudos to Patrick. And he's a jerk for a variety of reasons. He did the thing that I wanted. Look at that handsome face shaking his head. He did the thing that I wanted to do. Like, that's what I wanted to do. And, he talked through it. And he's doing acting. He's on freaking Netflix. I can download Patrick's face on it. You know, I so wanted to do that thing. And I wanted to do improv. And I am a hilarious dude. Like, I would crush. Absolutely crush late night, absolutely crush comedy.
Yeah, we'll have to work on your confidence, but otherwise I think you've got what it is.
No, I'm way too confident. I'm overconfident to a flaw. And I've always wanted to be that guy, but I would sit down and I would just be like, man, is this the, and so I have the personality. I know I can build the skills. I could definitely build a following, but is this the right, is this the safest route? Mm-hmm. Is this the best route for somebody who has a bleeding disorder? And is it the right, like, I know I love it. I know I'd have fun, but like Patrick mentioned, I'd have to throw everything into it. And there's no, like, when you do that, there's very, like, the plan B, it doesn't exist, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking there during the HEMWORK conversation. So it's so that, and so I said the safe thing, and I regret it to the extent, because passions are wonderful, but I did the safe thing. I said, listen, I can do technology. I can find a way to have a high-paying, successful career in technology. Why don't I just do that? It seems easier. I'm good at business. Why don't I do the business thing? Why don't I prove to the world that I'm good at the business stuff? And then I think it'll be, you know, safe. It's the three things we talked about: the safe, stable, happy. Right? I'll be safe. You know, it'll make some stability for me, and then I'll be happy doing it. I enjoy it. But man, like Patrick's talking about what he did. I'm like, damn it. You know, like, he did the thing that I wanted to do. And I met another gentleman in Oklahoma City who was an improv. He ran an improv, the improv group for Oklahoma City, actually. He ran for a number of years, 5, 10. And it was his passion. And his name is Clint. he ran the Oklahoma City, you know, just like Second City or just like the Groundlings. I don't know how professional it is on the, you know, I don't know how high level the Oklahoma City improv group is in the big scheme of things, but he made that happen. But guess what? So I'm in a technology role. 10 years later, he's coming to me looking for a job. And I said, Clint, you did it, man. Like, how did you not just keep pushing that until it happened? And he's like, John, you know what? You get tired of peanut butter sandwiches and cup of noodles mm-hmm. after a decade, you know? Mm-hmm. And he's mm-hmm. like, I'm so happy I did that for 10 years. But he's coming in. He's doing data science. He eclipsed me in his ability to code very early on because I'm a terrible coder. I suck at coding. I learned that in college. That was good. You know, and now he's doing big data projects for, you know, a $3 billion tech company, especially when yeah. you're that deep, just like Patrick, you know, when you're that deep and have to walk away from it, I respect, and everybody in the bleeding disorder community is going to have to find that answer for themselves. Is do I stay with my passions and build it and become that thing that, whether it's an actor or a producer or a actor who became a producer, whatever it might be, or is it a data scientist, or is it somebody who works in the business tech, you know, greasing the two like I do on a daily basis, you know, talking about business problems and how technology can help transform them. You got to figure that out for yourself, and it's an exciting yeah. task, but it's high stress and it has real impact. You make the wrong decision, you know, and it can, you know, it can hurt you, but you can always course correct. And that's what I tell people, is just because you made the wrong decision or you need to go in a different direction, that's all learning. Like, that's great.
Right.
I had a conversation with somebody in their 20s recently about the realities of her chosen profession. And I think the 20s in particular, at least it was for me, and I'm sure you guys can, you know, agree that the 20s, so much of it is like figuring out the realities and to become aware and astute enough to realize there are realities of such a profession like improv or the music industry or theater mm-hmm. in New York, that you can make decisions of this is the reality of what this life will be, and you can either choose to do it or to not do it. But there are just hardcore realities. You know, I think Chris Bombardier, there were realities of what he chose to do that he chose to do. And right. I mean, you know, fully believe in your choice. And I don't think they're right or wrong. I feel like I've had like three different careers, which is great and insane. And you can always go back to school. My dad told me when I got out of theater, there'll always be another show. And I've always kept that in the back of my brain of like, there'll always be another show. There'll always be another improv opportunity for you, John, somewhere random when your kids are in college. And like, you can do it, you know? So I think, anyway, the realities of professions, you know, I think that's what your 20s are about. And I'm still experiencing that too. Now in my 40s. I'm in my 40s. I'm in a whole new decade.
How are you that old? How is that a thing that you look like a baby?
crazy. You know, so there's so much in what you each just said that resonates. To go back, Amy, to your prompt initially, in terms of when I think back to being, you know, for me, finding performance was the first time I felt like I had a community. And I've talked about this in the context often of breaking through and why we do mm-hmm. that program, because I was a kid who, with an inhibitor, with bad joints, morbidly obese, I was not playing sports as much as I wanted to. And it wasn't until I found theater that I felt a place where I could connect with others, I could express myself, I was accepted, I had a role, we got to wear uniforms just like the sports teams did, and there's a lot more girls here, so I was like, this is pretty good, I like this, this is an advantage me. And then I went to school for it, and I'm so thankful that my mother let me pursue going to a rigorous undergraduate conservatory for a degree in acting. That's a very specific thing to do, especially when you had only just started getting into theater. But what I did come to learn, I was very lucky. I had a lot of professional opportunities while I was still a student to work in big company shows, big Shakespeare or Restoration comedies, where you'd have 8, 10, 12 people who have had a decade plus of careers and television shows and movies, the green room, what people are talking about. So I got to absorb so much while I was in school. Yeah. And I remember in particular one night we were walking home in Boston snowstorm back to the housing, and there's a lady there she was in her 60s at the time, early 60s, and she was talking about how she had lost her mom the year prior. Now, this is a phenomenal actress, been nominated at that point, I think, at least once for a Tony, tons of credits, seems to know everybody. And she's talking about how her mom died, and that was hard on her. And she mentioned very casually in the course of this group conversation that, of course, additionally, in addition to the emotional hardship of that, her mother had continued to support her a little bit financially, and she had been hurting in that way, too. And it hit me like a stack of bricks, because I looked at this woman and thought, like, you are incredible. Like, I want what you've got, like what you bring to the table and your career. Right. You know everybody. You're doing all this stuff. And then she said that.
Right.
But I was seeing things like that a lot amongst people who I was like, these are successful people in the arts and entertainment. But the lifestyle of it was so difficult that even success looked like something I was not interested in. And I've also taken us like well over time. John, you're going to come back on, so I'm not really worried about like the end of the conversation. But I guess as we do start to wrap up, Amy and I, before you came on, talked a little about the HemeWorks series and why we think it's important and what it's doing.
Right.
But maybe could you share a little bit with listeners why you think they might want to go check out the HemeWorks video series that you participated in?
HemeWork is wonderful because it addresses questions that the bleeding disorder community has had for a long time in a very short format, concise way to not only address the concerns people have when it comes to workplace or career planning for people, young people with bleeding disorders, but how what it looks like on the other side. And I think especially if you're a caregiver, that's a deep question that you ask yourself daily, is where is my child with a bleeding disorder going to be? What does the other side of this look like when they're 20, 24, 25, you know, 30, 37? And that HemeWorks is wonderful because it gives context to that dialogue. And it's not all, you know, rosy. It's not all cupcakes and sugar and sunshine. There's some challenges, but if you stay focused, if you build that circle around you to help support you through your journey, then looking at the other side, it's more like a rainbow. You know, there might not be a pot of gold at the end, but there's another side to the rainbow that won't look bad. And I'm excited that it'll hopefully help some people that are developing, some caregivers in the community to understand what that journey is, and that A, they're not alone, and B, it's, you know, you'll get there. And I think that's what a lot of the community doesn't know standing there today, right? Is A, am I going to be okay? And B, what is it going to look like? And you're going to make it. You're going to do well. Just use your head, use your time, talent, energies, and passions, and you'll make it to the other side of the rainbow.
I couldn't have said it better myself. My goodness. It was great.
Thank you, John, for sharing your story with HemeWork, HemeWork.com, and with us here today on the Bloodstream Podcast.
Before we go, I want to mention something that feels important to me.
Oh, okay.
Is that okay?
Please
do. Is that
do.
Okay? So with the election in just 67 days, 13 hours, 6 minutes, and 45 seconds.
Whoa.
I can't take it.
Again, that's 67 days, 13 hours, 6 minutes, and 37 seconds. I just want to remind everyone to vote. It is your civil duty. It is your right. It is your privilege. And this year's really, really important. Vote.org is a great website you can go to. It's very easy to remember, vote.org. There's so many websites you...
That's like as simple as bleedingdisorders.com.
I know. Takeda and vote.org, you know? But what's cool about vote.org is you can check your registration. You can register to vote. It says it takes less than 2 minutes to register. You can sign up to vote by mail. You can get election reminders. You can pledge to register. You can get a polling place locator. You can fill out your 2020 census. And then you can find everything you need to vote in your specific state, including election deadlines, dates, and rules. Super organized, really easy to read. Vote.org. Just do it. Everyone needs to vote this year.
And this is the year to vote early.
Well, thank you, Nellie. It is very important, so appreciate that. Thank you. And thanks to everyone at Believe Limited and Bloodstream Media, as that is all for this episode. Thanks as well to Takeda, our presenting sponsor, once again, bleedingdisorders.com, and to Genentech, our segment sponsor. And check out HemeWork, HemeWork.com to learn more about that program. Subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast, leave us a rating in the Apple Store, and share the show with others. Word of mouth is literally the best way we can reach new people. Listen and subscribe to Amy Board's It's in the Genes podcast as well. Shout out to BioMarin for making that possible. Tell us what you want to hear more about. Bloodstream Media on Facebook and YouTube, Bloodstream Info on Instagram and Twitter, or email us mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. And we'll be back next week with more. Until then, my name is Patrick James Lynch.
My name is Amy Board.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself and be safe out there. Bye, everybody.